From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. According to the polls, the presidential race is very tight, leading many people to wonder whether the election will end up in the courts, as it did 4 years ago. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from lawyers on both sides of the Florida recount legal battle. First, we talk with David Boies, who represented the Gore-Lieberman ticket. He has a new memoir called Courting Justice, in which he talks about Bush v. Gore and other famous cases he's taken on, including representing the Justice Department in its antitrust suit against Microsoft and representing Napster against the recording industry. Then we'll hear from Ted Olson, who represented the Bush-Cheney ticket in the Supreme Court 4 years ago. He served as U.S. Solicitor General under George W. Bush and recently returned to private practice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush and Senator John Kerry are preparing for their third and final presidential debate to be held tomorrow night in suburban Phoenix. Mark Moran reports from member station KJZZ.
President Bush and Senator Kerry will debate domestic issues in Gamage Auditorium on the campus of Arizona State University in Tempe, just outside Phoenix. The Round Theater was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, based on plans he drafted for an auditorium in Baghdad, but scrapped after King Faisal II, who commissioned it, was assassinated in 1958. Kerry and Bush have been regulars in Arizona during their campaigns, talking about veterans affairs, immigration reform, and prescription drugs for seniors, among other things. Both candidates will attend rallies after the debate. The president will overnight here while Kerry leaves for Nevada. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is asking healthy adults to forego a flu shot this year. British regulators have closed the Chiron Corporation plant that was supposed to produce nearly half the U.S. supply. The remaining vaccine is produced by the drug maker Aventis. The head of the CDC, Dr. Julie Gerberding, says any unshipped vaccine will be given to those who need it most.
We are taking the unshipped vaccine in collaboration with Aventis and then looking at how can we use those remaining 22.4 million doses to meet the priority needs that both Aventis and Chiron had anticipated.
People in the highest risk categories include infants, the elderly, and people with chronic medical conditions. In the southern Gaza Strip, a schoolgirl was shot and critically wounded today. Her UN-run school in the Palestinian refugee camp of Khan Yunis came under fire from the Israeli army. The military says Israeli troops were answering mortar shells fired on a Jewish settlement in the area and that it's investigating the incident. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Jerusalem.
11-year-old Khadr Muhaimer was seriously wounded by a live bullet in the chest as she stood outside the school. There have been a number of attacks near UN facilities in recent weeks, and the UN chief in Gaza has called on Israel to halt them. The shooting death of a 13-year-old girl last week, also in southern Gaza, has caused an uproar. Her body was riddled with 20 bullets. Soldiers have told the Israeli media that their platoon commander wanted to confirm that the girl, whom troops said was moving suspiciously toward them, was dead and emptied his ammunition cartridge into her. The commander says a group of rebellious soldiers invented the story. The army has opened a criminal investigation. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 4 points to close at 10,077 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 3 points to 1925. This is NPR News. A new study says millions of American college students are failing to apply for federal financial aid and may be missing a big opportunity to help them pay for their higher education. The report was prepared by ACE, the American Council on Education, which represents colleges and universities across the country. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
The study by ACE found that half of the 8 million college undergraduates during the 99-2000 academic year didn't fill out the main federal aid application form. Many of these students came from affluent families, so they wouldn't have qualified for financial assistance. But the study found that some 1.7 million of them came from low and moderate income families, and that many of them would have been eligible for a Pell Grant, the main source of low-income federal aid, if they had applied. The study bolsters an argument made by many educators educators that even though college tuitions continue to rise, there are opportunities for help that many students fail to exploit. The report urges colleges, schools, and policymakers to do a better job at educating students about available aid and to simplify a complicated application process. Anthony Brooks, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether it's constitutional to display the Ten Commandments on government property. Lower courts have given conflicting rulings on the issue. The justices will consider a large granite monument with the commandments on the grounds of the Texas State Capitol and another case involving framed copies of the commandments on display at county courthouses in Kentucky. Opponents of the displays say they amount to government endorsement of specific religions. Supporters say they represent the basis of U.S. law and culture. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With Kerry and Bush so close in the polls, many people are wondering if this year's election will be decided in the courts, like the election of 2000. A little later, we'll hear from Ted Olson, who represented the Bush-Cheney ticket in the Supreme Court. My first guest, David Boies, represented the Gore-Lieberman ticket in the Florida courts and the Supreme Court. In his new book, Courting Justice, Boies writes about Bush v. Gore, as well as other famous cases he's taken on. He helped defend IBM and its antitrust fight against the government, and represented the Justice Department in its antitrust case against Microsoft. He unsuccessfully defended Napster against the Recording Industry of America, which accused Napster of facilitating copyright infringement. Boies' clients have included Gary Shandling, Calvin Klein, and Don Imus. I asked Boies if he's concerned that there will be major tabulation errors or foul play in next month's presidential election.
I think there are three kinds of things to be concerned about. First, the new electronic voting machines that are present in some counties for the first time that do not have any paper trail at all and hence cannot be checked, I think is a very troubling development. Second, there are attempts to take off the voter rolls people who have registered because they have not met some technical requirement of checking a particular box. I mean, for example, there are a lot of new voter registrants who specifically are asked whether they are a citizen and they affirm that they are, and then there's another box that may not be checked. And this is the kind of technical issue that we confronted last time, although the situation was reversed. There were Republican ballots where the voter had not filled in a particular voter registration identification number that they were supposed to. And the Florida courts ruled that those ballots had to be counted. Now we have a situation in which the Republicans are taking exactly the opposite view and attempting to exclude a large number of new registrants from Democratic and minority districts that would prevent them from voting. A third problem that I think is of concern is what we saw in the last election, which were incidents, and they were not widespread, but there were more than would justify calling them isolated incidents, where people were actually made more difficult to get to the voting polls, where you had roadblocks, where you had diversion of traffic, predominantly in African-American districts, that raised very troubling issues.
Is there a precedent set by the Gore v. Bush decision that you think, or by any of the court decisions along the way, that you think might end up applying to this election?
I think that certainly the precedent that was established last year in Florida, where the Republican votes were held by the courts to be counted, even though they had failed to meet certain technical requirements, certainly ought to apply to this election as well. You can't change the rules election by election. You can't have one rule for Republican ballots and another rule for Democratic ballots. So I would hope that the courts would quickly affirm that these new registrants will be entitled to have their votes counted. So I think that precedent is an important one. Now, whether or not the actual Bush v. Gore decision by the United States Supreme Court will come into play, I think it's hard to tell. I think that if you read the opinion the way you would read a normal judicial opinion and applied it, what you would find is that the prospect of having materially different kinds of voting machines in different counties in Florida, such that your chance of actually having your vote accurately counted, varies county by county, depending on the kind of voting machine that is in place. You would find that to be a violation of equal protection. Now, I don't think that that's what the courts are going to hold, because I think, in general, I think the courts are going to put Bush v. Gore on the shelf for a while. But I think that if you did apply that precedent, the fact that you have in Florida for this election different kinds of voting machines in different counties, and those different kinds of voting machines materially affect the chances of somebody's vote being accurately counted, would be a problem.
What do you mean when you say that the Bush v. Gore decision is likely to be put on the shelf for a while?
I think the equal protection argument that the five-justice majority opinion articulated was something, as I discuss in my book, was contrary to the principles that had previously been announced, particularly by the justices that were in the majority. And I think it probably applies a principle that they will not be prepared to apply in the future, which is one of the reasons that I am as critical of that opinion as I am. In a really remarkable article that is in this month's, October's, Vanity Fair, the October issue of Vanity Fair, David Margalek, who has gone and interviewed Supreme Court law clerks and done a lot of other reporting, talks about the extent to which even some of the justices that joined in that majority opinion, particularly Justice Scalia, disparages in very strong terms, probably too strong for the FCC to allow me to use on radio, the majority opinion, the majority opinion that he himself joined in. So I think that there is a general recognition that that opinion has a lot of problems with it and probably would not be applied, at least in the near term. One of the good things about Supreme Court's opinions, or bad thing about Supreme Court opinions, is that it can sort of sit there for a long time and then be resurrected. And some of us who believe that the Equal Protection Clause should be more broadly applied, I think, have an hope that future courts will take that precedent and apply it for good purposes.
Let me ask you to, explain the equal protection argument that the Supreme Court used.
What the Supreme Court majority opinion, the 5-4 majority opinion in Bush v. Gore, said was that because local canvassing boards in Florida are set up on a county-by-county basis, and they were looking at the ballots, separate county canvassing boards were looking at the ballots for their respective counties, and they could interpret a ballot's intent differently, that meant that voters in one county had a greater chance of having their vote counted than voters in another county. For example, the canvassing board in one county might decide that they were not going to count a ballot unless the punch card was punched cleanly and completely all the way through. The canvassing board in another county might look at a ballot that hadn't been punched all the way through, but because of the pattern of indentations, they would believe that they could determine that that was the voter's intent. And under Florida law for more than 80 years, the Florida courts and the Florida legislature had established a principle that said it doesn't make any difference whether the voter actually complies with the technical requirements of voting, as long as you can determine the voter's intent. That's never been viewed as an equal protection problem by the majority of the Supreme Court. But what they did here is say, because voters in one county may have a vote counted that would not have been counted in another county, that's a violation of equal protection.
What was your interpretation of equal protection when different counties are using different types of ballots in the first place?
Well, I think that is a very good question, because one of the things that we said to the Supreme Court was that the chances of having your vote counted because your county is using a different voting machine is far more likely to be affected than your chance of voting being affected by the county canvassing board standard. There was undeniable statistical evidence that demonstrated that where you had OCR, or optical character recognition machines, your chances of having your vote counted were materially better than counties that used the old punch card machines. So if there was an equal protection argument of the type that the majority opinion in the Supreme Court adopted, that would have invalidated the entire Florida election. And of course, if you invalidated the entire Florida election, Al Gore would have had a majority of both the electoral and the popular vote.
My guest is David Boies. His new memoir is called Courting Justice. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Boies, and he has a new book called Courting Justice, from New York Yankees versus Major League Baseball to Bush versus Gore. And he is a very famous lawyer who, among other things, represented Gore in the Bush v. Gore recount case. Do you think that both Democrats and Republicans are preparing now for a recount, or, you know, for a contest to the election, since the race is again so tight?
I think they are, and I know that both Republican lawyers and Democratic lawyers are preparing to challenge various aspects of the voting. I think that's inevitable in a case where you're going to have an election that looks like it's going to be as close this time as it was last time.
Are you involved?
My firm is, and I've done some work on it, and if it gets to the same type of controversy, I will be again.
What do you think the odds are that it will get to that level of controversy?
I would hope it won't. I would hope that we've learned a lesson from last time. I think the electoral process was diminished. I think the United States Supreme Court's aura was diminished. I think the reliability and stability of our democracy was diminished by what happened last time. I think that one of the critical hallmarks of our society has always been that we wanted people to vote, we wanted people to be able to vote, and we wanted to have all the votes counted. And I think when you depart from that for a particular partisan purpose in a particular election, you undermine something far more important than the results of any particular election. You undermine the real stability and respect that we have and the world has for our democratic institutions.
What are the parts of the recount process and the legal campaigns on both sides that you thought were most partisan?
I think the things that were most partisan in terms of the last election were, first, the attempt to prevent Florida counties from doing what they have done in every prior election, which is to look at ballots and make a determination of the voter's intent. The Florida Supreme Court repeatedly ruled in the 2000 election and had repeatedly ruled in other elections for over 80 years that in a close election, the right way to proceed is for the local canvassing board to look at the ballots themselves and make a determination of the voter's intent. And that's what was being done when the United States Supreme Court on Saturday, December 9th, ruled that that was not going to go forward and ordered Florida to stop counting the votes. And I think that that was an unfortunate injection of partisanship into something that has generally, in Florida and elsewhere, been relatively free from partisanship. There have always been problems with voting, isolated problems with voting. There were famous problems in Texas and Cook County and Louisiana that a lot of people are familiar with. But those were always things that were done surreptitiously. They were wrong. They were unfortunate. They sometimes affected elections. But they were the kind of incidents that everybody on both sides agreed shouldn't happen. What was different about the last election was that you didn't have people skulking around in the dead of night stuffing a ballot box. You had official parts of our government, indeed the part of our government that I think we all expect to be most neutral, intervening and ordering the state of Florida not to continue to count ballots that they were in the middle of counting.
What was your favorite part of the dissenting opinions from the Supreme Court?
There were a lot of them, a lot of favorite parts. I thought that Justice Stevens' dissent was one of the most elegant opinions, majority or dissent, that I've read. I think that what Justice Ginsburg wrote, as well as Justices Souter's and Breyer, were also very persuasive. I think that, for example, one of the points that Justice Ginsburg makes very powerfully is that the majority justices are justices that have repeatedly made deference to state courts an article of faith. They have justified all sorts of revisions of the law, all sorts of retractions of the exercise of federal power, on the grounds that the court, the Supreme Court, must defer to state courts, even when the state courts are wrong. And yet here were these same majority justices in an extraordinary intervention into an interpretation of state law, using the Equal Protection Clause to invalidate what the Florida Supreme Court had done not only in this election, but in elections involving both Republican and Democratic winners over 80 years. I think that the point that Justice Stevens makes in his dissent, in which he points out how this opinion undercuts the respect that the public has for the court system, the credit that I think people give the courts as being, and particularly the Supreme Court, as being above partisan politics, doesn't mean that they don't have strong views and they don't intervene in what are essentially sometimes political interests and political issues. But it has meant that they don't do so in a partisan way. They don't try to put a judicial thumb on the electoral scale. And I think that what Justice Stevens was saying is that when the court did that in this instance, the court undercut some of the moral authority that is the basis of its power. It is not an elected institution. Remarkably, in our most democratic society, we give the most final complete power to our least democratic institution. We do so with the faith that they will not use that power for partisan purposes. And when you have a decision like Bush v. Gore, I think you begin to undercut that faith and hence undercut the court's power.
I'm sure a lot of people have been thinking as they listen to us talk about the Florida recount is, doesn't he ever give up? You know, that was over, that was settled, 4 years ago. So let me ask you about that. What do you think is, do you think it's important to reconsider that case and reconsider the opinion, or do you think it's important to put that behind us and just move on?
I think it is certainly important to put the results of that election behind us and move on, and that's one of the points that I make in the book, which is that we must have, if we're going to have a society that operates under the rule of law, we have to have a way of reaching these decisions, and we have to have a respect for that decision-making mechanism that is sufficient, that allows us to accept it and to move on. One of the things that I said in 2000 and 2001 was that we needed to accept the Supreme Court's decision before they rendered their decision. I said if they intervened and made a decision, that would be final. After they rendered their decision, I said we have to accept that decision as resolving this electoral controversy. I distinguish between accepting that decision and moving on and having the country move on from looking at the process by which that decision was made and the merits of that decision, because I think it's important to focus on that in terms of making sure that if it was a wrong decision, that error is not repeated. If you go to the United States Supreme Court building in Washington, one of the things that you see, and this is a display put on by the United States Supreme Court itself, you see a discussion of some of the key opinions that the Supreme Court has issued. And very, very prominently displayed are some of the worst decisions that the Supreme Court has ever made. The Dred Scott decision, where the United States Supreme Court upheld slavery and, in fact, ruled that even the free states could not prevent somebody from bringing a slave, another human being, into their borders and continuing to have a property interest in that human being. Plessy against Ferguson, in which the Supreme Court upheld segregation, upheld apartheid in this country. Those were, I think, generally recognized as among the worst decisions of the United States Supreme Court. And yet, here is the Supreme Court picking those decisions as some of the most important ones to display in the lobby of the Supreme Court. And I think the court does that for the reason of trying to make sure that those kinds of decisions don't reappear and are not repeated. And I think that if you have a case like Bush v. Gore that in a number of respects I think is wrong, I think it is important that we in the bar, the courts themselves, the public, everyone who has an interest in the justice system, look at those decisions on the merits in a reflective and hopefully respectful way. And I think that's good for our democracy, and I think it's ultimately good for the court itself.
David Boies, his new memoir is called Courting Justice. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting the new political satire Tanner on Tanner, starring Cynthia Nixon, from series creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, tonight at 9. And from Nonsuch Records, featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Chicago band Wilco, on tour across the U.S., available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Boies on how he handled the gotcha moment in the antitrust suit against Microsoft. Then we'll hear from Boies' adversary and friend, Ted Olson. Olson represented the Bush-Cheney ticket in the Supreme Court 4 years ago. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Boies. In his new memoir, Courting Justice, Boies writes about some of the famous cases he's taken on. 4 years ago, during the Florida recount, he represented the Gore Lieberman ticket in the Florida courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. He's represented CBS against General Westmoreland's charges of libel, defended Napster against the recording industry, and represented the Justice Department in its antitrust case against Microsoft. Lately, you've been representing some corporations where executives have been accused of messing with the books or taking advantage of, you know, of the company. I'm thinking of Tyco and Adelphia.
Yes.
What are some of the differences between doing corporate work like that and doing a political case like Bush v. Gore? You know, and a lot of people are so angry at these corporations now.
Yes, and well, they should be, because the corporate misconduct that has existed in Tyco and Adelphia and WorldCom and NCI and Enron and other companies like that has, I think, undermined people's confidence in our corporate system and to some extent in our free market system. Much like I think Bush v. Gore risked undermining some of the respect that we have for the justice system. In both Tyco and Adelphia, I and my firm were retained by the board of directors when they became suspicious of conduct that was going on. And we went through a process of investigating it and ultimately recommending and participating in the replacement and firing of the top executives in each of those companies. And we have then gone on to sue the former executives for the misconduct and for the looting that they did of the corporations that they were running. One of the things that I have been very proud of is the fact that in the case of both Tyco and Adelphia, the board was prepared to stand up and bring in people not beholden to the top executives and to face up to their responsibilities of, when it became necessary, actually removing the people that they had hired. The companies have gone after the wrongdoers. And, for example, in the case of Tyco, by restoring investor confidence in the company avoided bankruptcy, and the stock very substantially recovered under new management. So it shows that it's possible to take a situation that is very troubling because you've had breaches of fiduciary duty and people acting in a wrong, irresponsible way, and still protect the shareholders, who, after all, are the people who are supposed to be protected by management and by the board.
You have been doing antitrust work for many years, I mean, from the start
Yes.
of your career on. And one of your more celebrated cases was representing the U.S. against Microsoft in the antitrust suit. And there was one particularly dramatic moment in that, in which you brought up that a videotape that Microsoft had entered as evidence was not a real-time demonstration, but it was actually a series of spliced-together moments. And
Yes.
would you describe the significance of this videotape and how your team figured out that it wasn't a real-time demonstration?
Yes, it was a videotape that Microsoft had introduced at trial, and it was a great videotape. It was a very persuasive videotape. It purported to show exactly what Microsoft had been arguing, which is that if you had the kind of remedy that the government was arguing for, it would diminish the performance of computers. And that went right to the heart of Microsoft's argument, its defense, which is that its products worked well because they bundled them all together. And if you unbundled them, the performance would be degraded. And we had a hard time, in fact, we had an impossible time, replicating that result on the computers that we had. On the other hand, it was very difficult to prove, contrary to what they said in court, that this was a single computer operating under a single set of programs. Because when somebody gets on the stand and they've got a videotape and it purports to show something and they say it shows exactly what they say it's showing, there's not a lot that you can often do. What we had here, however, were a very impressive group of people helping from Princeton and elsewhere. And what they did was they printed out screenshots sort of every second and then compared them. And you can pick up that way things that the naked eye may not see. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we discovered was that you could tell by the appearance, disappearance, and reappearance of program icons that it could not be the same computer. And so we were able to demonstrate that on cross-examination.
So
one of the things
when you knew that you were going to challenge this videotape in cross-examination, this is a real gotcha moment. This is like a real dramatic moment. Yeah. How did you figure out how you wanted to play it?
Well, what we did was we played the videotape all the way through. It was only 4.5 minutes, this particular segment, and got the witness to reaffirm that this was a single computer operating under a single computer program, that they'd not spliced anything together. And then we played about 90 seconds and froze it. And we had an enormous screen in the courtroom. So everybody in the courtroom could see broadcast onto this screen what the computer screen looked like. And in the left-hand column, there was a list of the programs that were running, the program icons. And I got the witness to identify those, and then I played it another minute or so, froze it, and one of those icons had disappeared. And that was a very dramatic moment because, as the witness had to admit, that could not have happened. Programs just don't appear or disappear. And he could not begin to explain what had happened or how that could have happened. I then played it for another minute or so and then froze it again. And this time, every eye in the courtroom glanced up at that screen. And every eye in the courtroom saw that the icon had reappeared. And the courtroom was completely silent. And you could hear Microsoft lawyer whisper to his table, "Oh, expletive deleted." And when that happened, everyone in the court felt Microsoft's credibility as well as the witness's credibility draining away.
What did you want your voice to convey and the way that you were asking questions or making your demonstratory statements to convey?
Well, in the beginning, what you want to convey is how clear the videotape is of what it purports to show.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to set that up so that when you demolish it, it's clear what you've demolished. And then when you show the first disappearance of the program, you want your voice and your manner to express your incredulity, the impossibility of this, your wonderment almost at what possibly could be happening. And you want to be saying to the witness, "Well, can you give me any explanation for this? Do you have any possible explanation for how this could have happened?" And then when you have proven when it's reappeared that it's been spliced not once but repeatedly, you want to convey your concern, your outrage, the problems with that kind of conduct.
Do you think the person on the stand knew what was happening? Do you think that they knew that the tape was not a continuous sequence?
I have a hard time believing that he did, just because he seems like such a decent guy.
Mm-hmm.
How it happened, I really don't have an explanation to this day. Somebody obviously had to know because somebody spliced it. And to some extent, even if he didn't know, the witness bears a certain culpability because he got on the witness stand to sponsor it, and he purported to have assured himself that it was a single computer. But how it happened, who was responsible, who did it, is something that I don't know, and probably will never know.
Now, another thing that has been written about you a lot and that you write about in your book, Courting Justice, is that you're dyslexic. And back in your student days, you had a lot of trouble. You know, reading is difficult, so you read selectively. You try to read the most important stuff. What are some of the ways you've gotten around that over the years?
Well, I think the ways that you indicate are basically the ways you read selectively.
That's hard to do because you don't really know what's going to be important sometimes.
That's true. But what you have to do is you have to figure out what you think is going to be important.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you do is you develop a certain amount of judgment when you have to be making those selections all the time as to what's important. You also develop techniques. Like I will skim pretty fast until I come to something that looks like it may be important, and then I'll slow down and laboriously read it. And part of it is learning how to absorb information in ways other than reading.
Like what?
By talking to people,
mm-hmm.
By listening. Mm-hmm. I'm a very good listener. That helps a great deal in trials because I really remember what people say, and I remember not only the substance of what they're saying, I remember the words. And that's part of what you develop, part of one of the techniques you develop in trying to deal with difficulty in reading. I learned, for example, in school, mostly by listening to lectures or participating in class as opposed to reading the books.
So when you're working on a case, do you have your associates read a lot of stuff and tell you in summary what they've read? Is it easier for you to absorb it that way?
Yes, I do that. I also read myself a lot of stuff. It just takes me a long time.
So you have a good memory.
I have a good memory. I do not have as good a memory as people sometimes say, but I do have a pretty good memory.
David Boies, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Boies' new memoir is called Courting Justice. Coming up, Boies' friend and legal adversary, Ted Olson. Olson represented the Bush-Cheney ticket in the Supreme Court Florida recount case. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from David Boies, who represented the Gore-Lieberman ticket in the Florida courts and the Supreme Court during the Florida recount. Ted Olson represented the Bush-Cheney ticket in the Supreme Court. After Bush became president, Olson was appointed Solicitor General. In July, he stepped down and returned to private practice. I spoke with Ted Olson earlier today. Do you think that this presidential election will likely be contested in the way that the 2000 election was? Do you think it will be so close that it will be contested?
Well, I don't know how close it's going to be, but all the polls say it's going to be close, and the experts are all saying that, so I suppose I have to defer to that. And to the extent that it does turn out to be as close or nearly as close as the 2000 election, it would not surprise me at all to see some sort of litigation in the states where the outcome is very close.
Would you be involved again?
Well, that would depend upon whether my clients from the year 2000 wanted me to do it again. I'm standing by and I'm ready to go.
I know that I believe that the Republicans are already preparing for the possibility of such a contested election. Are you in on the planning for that?
I am standing by. I'm not involved in any planning. From what I have read and what I have heard, both sides are making sure that there are lawyers available to them throughout the country just in case.
If there is a contested election again, what do you think are the precedents from 2000 that could be applied to 2004?
Well, the one that everybody thinks about are the two Bush versus Gore Supreme Court decisions. And those two decisions taken together stand for the proposition that there are federal constitutional and statutory requirements that deal with presidential elections, and the provisions in the Constitution and in the federal statute must be complied with, and that if necessary, federal courts will ensure that there is compliance with federal law. That is, both with respect to how members of the Electoral College from a particular state are selected, and with respect to the manner in which the ballots are counted, so that people in different places won't be treated in a substantially, arbitrarily dissimilar fashion.
The U.S. Supreme Court stopped the Florida recount in process, and then the case went to the Supreme Court. Do you think it's likely that if there are individual states in which the election is contested, that the Supreme Court would intervene?
If the recount is being conducted in an unconstitutional fashion, then the Supreme Court might. It's important to remember that in the Florida situation in the year 2000, the first time that the United States Supreme Court intervened, the court unanimously, 9-0, vacated a Florida Supreme Court decision that had set out a recount process that did not seem to comply with the federal statute. And the second time around, 7 of the 9 justices felt that the Equal Protection Clause requirements of equal treatment were being violated. By then it was December 12, which in the calendar year 2000 was the last date for compliance with certain federal requirements as to the counting of ballots. So while the Supreme Court stopped the recounting at that point, it did so because it perceived the process as being done in an unconstitutional fashion and that the deadline was up to comply with the Constitution to count the votes.
Now, my understanding of the equal protection argument that the Supreme Court used and that you argued in court was that, for instance, with the hanging chads and stuff, that individual counties, in fact, individual people might interpret that each of those votes differently, and that therefore each voter wouldn't have equal protection because somebody in one county might interpret a ballot as having enough light shining through the chad to be counted as a vote, and somebody in another county or in the next seat might not count it the same way. On the other hand, the different counties had different voting systems. Some of them had, you know, the system that led to the hanging chad. Some of them had electronic votes. The absentee vote was completely different, and there was the butterfly ballot. So, you know, some people have made the argument that if you're going to use the equal protection argument, then all of Florida violates equal protection. Since there were so many different voting systems, the voters weren't treated equally.
Well, the Supreme Court dealt with that, actually, in its opinion. In the 2000 case of Bush versus Gore, it said that simply because there are different types of ballots or different methods of counting the ballots in different areas of, in this case, Florida, does not violate the Equal Protection Clause. What the court found objectionable was an arbitrary and capricious manner of counting the votes differently in different counties. Remember, the rules were being changed sort of hourly in various different areas of the Florida system, and so that there was this massive unfairness, at least as the Supreme Court saw it, with respect to the changing of the rules and arbitrary and capricious different standards that were being applied to the recount process. It was not simply that there are different types of ballots in different areas, which are always have been and probably always will be.
My guest is Ted Olson. He represented the Bush-Cheney ticket 4 years ago in the Supreme Court. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is Ted Olson. He represented the Bush-Cheney ticket when the Florida recount case was heard in the Supreme Court 4 years ago. Republicans are often opposed to federal intervention into state issues. Do you think that the issue of the Florida recount should have actually gone to the Supreme Court?
Well, it wasn't a state issue. It was a matter of the presidential election, which is a federal issue. The Supreme Court had said several times before, as recently as 1983, that in the context of a presidential election, federal constitutional and statutory standards must be complied with in individual states because the votes in individual states affect the election throughout the United States for the president, the officer of the United States elected by all of the people.
Many Republicans are against what they describe as activist judges, and I'm wondering if you think this was an activist judicial decision to actually intervene like this and decide the election.
I think that what the court was doing was not an activist, or I hate that label because people use the word activist to describe whatever they don't like. Remember, the Supreme Court unanimously, 9-0, reversed the first Florida Supreme Court decision, and then 7 of the 9 justices felt that the second Florida Supreme Court decision imposed an unconstitutional process. So I think that what was concerning to Republicans and to the candidates that I represented was that the Florida Supreme Court had twice violated the Constitution in forcing a recount that didn't comply with federal constitutional and statutory standards, that if there was any activism at all, it was at that level. And what the United States Supreme Court did was to correct the erroneous process that had been put in play by the Florida Supreme Court.
Do you think that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision was a partisan decision?
No. I think it was a fair, honest interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, and I say so in part because I believe it, but also because 9 justices rejected the Florida effort the first time, and 7 of the 9 found that there were constitutional problems the second time around.
Now, our listeners may be surprised to hear that you and David Boies are friends. He says that in his book, and I think you agree with that.
I do. I have a great respect and affection for David Boies. I think he's an absolutely brilliant lawyer. I hardly can wait to read his book. And, you know, and he's just such a remarkable person. He's capable of doing so much. He's someone that's interesting to talk to on every different level. He's done so many different interesting things, and he's such an amiable person. He's a hard-charging, competitive person. There's no doubt about that. But he does it with poise and with class, and I admire him a great deal.
Does the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court decision from 2000, look any different to you now, 4 years later, as we face a new presidential election?
No, it does not, for the reason that what was happening down in Florida, in our opinion, in my opinion, was a process of taking away the statutory requirements for counting votes that had been enacted by the legislature and modifying those systems after the election. And when you do that after the election in a close contest, and when you count the votes in a way that can be manipulated by the persons counting them, that is not a fair process, and the Supreme Court was right to prevent that from happening.
If there is another contested election, and if you do participate in it, are there lessons from 2000 that you would be drawing on this time around?
Well, yes, we always try to learn something whenever we handle litigation. That was quite a difficult and fast-moving experience. I've reminded people when they think about that, that was 5 weeks. There were something like 3 Florida Supreme Court decisions and 2 United States Supreme Court decisions. Being able to assemble the legal work necessary to move that rapidly, especially at a time when, because all of the other litigation that was going on kept everybody from getting any sleep, I suppose we could be more efficient. I suppose that we could anticipate some of the issues. But these things are usually not exactly the same. And whatever you learn from the previous experience, you sort of have to learn a lot of different things all over again. I hope, for the sake of the winner and the non-winner in this election, and for the American people and all of us, that there isn't a large involvement of lawyers, that the election will be decisive, and that the procedures will be not only fair but be perceived to be fair, because I don't think it's, in the long run, good for the people to see lawyers and judges involved in counting votes and tabulating election. I think it's much better for the system if that does not happen.
Ted Olson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Ted Olson represented the Bush-Cheney ticket in the Supreme Court 4 years ago. Earlier in the show, we heard from David Boies, who represented the Gore-Lieberman ticket. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Lauren Krenzel. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting the new political satire Tanner on Tanner, starring Cynthia Nixon, from series creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, tonight at 9, and from Wiley, publishers of Banking on Baghdad, journalist Edwin Black's examination of 7,000 years of conflict and commerce in Iraq, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two former presidential candidates look at politics and the presidential race. Democrat Howard Dean has written a new book called You Have the Power. Conservative Pat Buchanan has written a new book called How the Right Went Wrong. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.